express myself in the hard language she used. But just thinking such words made me look around guiltily, as if Mammy were standing behind me with a hot pepper, set to rid me of the habit of vulgar speech. The other thing we liked about Titi Generosa was that even though she was a mother herself, she believed everything we told her, no matter how far-fetched. We told her Mammy didn't mind if we wandered around the neighborhood, when in fact, Mammy didn't allow us out of the front gate without permission, instructions for the exact route we were to take, and a promise to return at a strictly enforced time. We told Titi Generosa we didn't have to bathe daily, that we had no chores, that we could eat candy for lunch, and that we could wear whatever we wanted whenever we felt like it. Delsa and Norma, who liked to dress like princesses whenever possible, wore out their three good dresses in no time. Hector, who had a gift for talking people into doing things they weren't sure they wanted to do, ingratiated himself with the candy store owner down the street and spent most of his day helping the owner and himself. Affable, placid Alicia whiled away her days in bed, playing with dolls in tents constructed from Mommy's sheets. And Edna tagged along with whoever seemed to be having the most fun. I disappeared on long walks through forbidden streets, free of Mommy's vigilance. A couple of blocks from our house, on busy Avenida Roosevelt, I came upon an enormous round building, its zinc roof bright red, its walls adorned with murals of fierce fighting cocks with sharp beaks and murderous round eyes. It was ringed by hurricane fencing, a padlock sagged from a chain wrapped around the gate. From the rear of the building, cocks screeched furiously, their cries mingling with the roar of the avenue, their cries interrupted every so often by the lilting kikiriki of the roosters they once were. I felt sorry for those trapped birds, whose skinny legs were plucked to reveal spurs sharpened into lethal spikes. Across the avenue, which was so busy I was afraid to cross to the other side, a development was going up. From backhoes, cranes, cement mixing trucks, and men in hard hats came a roar of clanging metal, grinding gears, sliding gravel, and the occasional whistle at a passing woman. Further down, behind a new shopping center with "for rent" signs in the plate glass windows, a neighborhood of parcelas, little farms, slept within the rustle of mango and avocado trees. Skinny dogs lay in the sun of the unpaved road. Open sewers at either side obliterated the spicy smells wafting from cooking fires. Boys played stickball in dusty yards, while girls strolled in giggly groups of two and three. I heard them whisper at the impropriety of my roving about unaccompanied, but I didn't care. Unlike them, I had no one to whom I needed give account. The freedom I had gained from Titi Generosa's ingenuousness was usually given only to boys, and it set me apart from any friends I might have had at the time, whose mothers were as cautious as mine. I savored it, as I might savor an expensive piece of candy given only at Christmas. Behind Titi Generosa's back, we called her Titi Avena, Auntie Oatmeal, because oatmeal was all she cooked for us. Papi once asked why it was that there was never any food in the house, and we told him. He rubbed his chin and looked at us suspiciously, but didn't say anything. Another day, he gathered us on the back steps and told us that Titi Avena said we fought too much and gave her too many problems. "You must behave yourselves," he said, "or she won't come to watch you anymore." This was no threat, since the only choice would have been, we thought, Mommy's speedy return from New York. We didn't have to consult each other or come up with an elaborate plan. We simply did the exact opposite of what was expected, knowing we would be punished by Mommy when she returned, but willing to take the chance to have her back. We took every opportunity to make Titi Avena miserable. We played Caribs and Spaniards in the house, whooping and pretend dying around her as she stirred our oatmeal. Delsa, who had a more disciplined conscience than I did, tried to take over the role of responsible older sister, but we turned on her, sending her in tears to sit resentful and hurt in the corner of the yard while we broke furniture, tore bedding, and fought one another until we drew blood. I knew what we were doing was wrong, but it was fun, even though every night I went to bed worried that Mommy would show up and see the dirty house, the torn sheets, the disorder that Titi Avena tried to prevent but couldn't because she was outnumbered. At first, Papi didn't seem to notice what we were doing. He worked 7 days a week, dawn to dusk, and when he came home, he gave a look at the confusion in what was once an orderly, neat three-room house and shook his head, but didn't say much. One morning, however, he didn't go to work. When Titi Avena came, she helped me pack a bag, and Papi took me to Tio Lalo's house. "Why do I have to go there, Papi?" I cried on the bus. "Because your titi can't watch you kids, and I have to work, so I can't stay home and take care of you. Why doesn't Mommy come back?" "I don't know." He said it as if he didn't care if she ever returned. He had a cup of coffee and a piece of Tio Lalo's rice with coconut and raisins, then kissed me on the forehead. "You'll be a good girl now until your mother comes." I stood on the threshold of Tio Lalo's house, Gladys's watery eyes fixed on me, Angie's face hiding a smile, Angelina's cat-like voice meowing assurances that Mommy would be back soon, and then I could see my sisters and brothers again. The visit with my cousins took on a routine as dull and uninspired as the previous days had been exhilarating. Gladys and I rose early to peel potatoes, then we sat for hours in the front porch playing jacks or jumping rope to made-up rhymes. Occasionally, Angie joined us, but most of the time, she remained sequestered in her pink room, listening to the music we were forbidden in the rest of the house. I once considered running away and packed my belongings in the ragged bag Mammy had given me, but I didn't have the courage to step out of Tio Lalo's house into the large world beyond his stoop. I counted the days by the sacks of potatoes that Gladys and I peeled. Fingers burning, I stripped the hot skin off potatoes in silence, swallowing hurt and resentment with the same outward resignation that Gladys manifested. But although it seemed that Gladys had simply accepted her lot with meekness, I seethed, playing Titi Avena's dirtiest words inside my head as I dropped potato after potato into the bowl where they would be mashed. One potato, coño. Two potato, puñeta. Three potato, carajo. Dreams of a Better Life. Adiós, Candelaria hermosa. Las espaldas te doy dando. No siento lo que me llevo, sino lo que estoy dejando. Goodbye, lovely Candelaria. I turn my back to you. I feel not for what I take, but for what I leave behind. I couldn't believe it. I get home and everything's gone. The house is locked. The windows are shuttered. There's no sign that anyone lives there. So I ask the neighbor, who tells me Pablo moved. Didn't even write to me in New York. He just sold everything, packed off the kids, and went back to Macon. Angelina gasped. How did you find them? I went to Doña Margara's house. She told me. Mommy stroked my head, which lay relaxed and at home on her lap. Are we going back to Macon? I asked, hopeful. Nah, I'm not living there again. Is Papi going to live with us? She tightened her lips. Yes, of course. She stood up. Go get your things. We have to go. I stuffed my belongings into a bag, fingers shaking so hard I couldn't zipper the top. Mommy had come back from New York with cropped hair that formed a curly black ring around her face. Her nails were long and painted deep pink. She wore high heels and stockings that shadowed the blue lines on her legs. But besides her appearance, there was something new about her, a feeling I got from the way she talked, the way she moved. She had always carried herself tall, but now there was pride, determination, and confidence in her posture. Even her voice assumed a higher pitch that demanded to be heard. I was puzzled and frightened by this transformation, but at the same time enthralled by it. She was more beautiful than before, with eyes that seemed to have darkened as her skin glowed paler. Even Angelina remarked on this. "Qué bonita te ves," she had exclaimed, and we all had to look and agree that, yes, she looked very pretty. On the way to the bus, men stared, whistled, mumbled piropos. Eyes fixed straight ahead, she pretended to ignore the gallantries, but a couple of times her lips curled into a smile. I strolled next to her, half proud, half afraid. I had heard men speaking compliments in the direction of women, but I'd never been aware of them going to my mother. Each man who did a double take or pledged to love her forever, to take her home with him, to give his life for her, took her away from me. She had become public property, no longer the mother of 7 children, but a woman desired by many. I wanted to jump on those men and punch their faces in, to quiet the promises and the seductive looks, to chill the heat they gave off, palpable as the clothes I wore. During the entire bus ride home, I was miserable, wrapped in a rage I couldn't explain or think away. Mommy chattered about New York, my cousins, movies, and tall apartment buildings, but I didn't listen. I kept replaying the walk to the bus stop, her proud bearing, the men's stares, their promises, and the nakedness her accessible beauty made me feel. Our new place in Sabana Seca was a pretty finca at the end of a cul-de-sac by a golf course. A creek ran at the side of the property, dividing us from the large house next door, which Mami said belonged to una gente rica, rich folks. On the other side of us was the home of Doña Lina and Don José, their children, and their television set. We had seen television before, but this was the first time we were captivated by the figures on the screen. Tom and Jerry, El Pato Donald, and El Ratoncito Mickey Mouse delighted us with their adventures. Superman burst through walls, lifted cars, and caught people falling out of buildings before they hit the ground. Tarzan let out mighty yelps and swung from limb to limb on vines that looked suspiciously like ropes decorated with sweet potato vines. All the male characters, cartoon or live action, sounded like the same two people, José Miguel Agrelot or Jacobo Morales, two of my favorite radio voices. It took me a long time to figure out that the programs were actually in English, dubbed into Spanish, and after that I enjoyed them less because I spent most of my time watching the mouths move out of synchronization with the voices. Papi was never a part of this entertainment. He had converted what used to be a tool shed into his private world, with a padlock on the door and curtained windows from which sometimes rose sweet-smelling smoke. He came home, ate dinner, and disappeared into his room with a lit candle and books and magazines. We knew better than to disturb him. He was as withdrawn as a person can be and still live in the same household, morose, preoccupied with matters that were none of our business. Once, while he was in the latrine, I sneaked into his spice-scented hideaway and rifled through a stack of Rosicrucian literature and a book by Nostradamus. Just touching the pages gave me the creeps. Illustrations of disasters and Holocaust bloomed over the turbaned heads of men with bulging eyes of frightening intensity. The texts were in formal Spanish, with thee and thou and grammar that was hard to follow. On a small table by the window, an unmarked bottle of amber liquid sparkled next to a chipped bowl with ashes. A strange energy shadowed the corners of the room. The air seemed to circle on itself, confined by the narrow walls. I ran out, breathless, my heart beating fast, chills curling my tailbone. I got my own room, off the kitchen, with a curtain for a door. In it, Mammy put a cot with its own mosquito net, a small table and chair, and a basket for my underclothes. Papi nailed a rod in the corner where I hung my uniform and good clothes. "Now you keep this room neat," Mami said. "You know you're almost señorita and should learn how to take care of things." From his toolbox, Papi pulled out a package of green thumbtacks. "You can use these to pin pictures and poems on the wall," he said, handing me a portrait of the governor. I clipped out flowers from cans of carnation milk and pinned a wreath around cutouts of the little girl under an umbrella from the salt box and of Mr. Quacker from the box of oatmeal. Edna drew me a horse, and Hector gave me one of his best marbles, which I set on a small pedestal carved from a dried avocado pit. The first night, I couldn't sleep. The floorboards were pocked with holes where knots had fallen out. Cold air blew in, whistling a mournful tune like the dead singing. I pulled the sheets up to my chin and tucked my head between my arms. Under the house, hens cackled softly, while the flapping of wings above sounded like secret applause. I rolled into a ball in the middle of the mattress, cold sweat nipping my back. I missed Delsa's warmth, the secure feeling of sleeping in a room full of people. I tossed until dawn, unused to so much room on the bed, while on the other side of the wall, my sisters and brothers slept, their bodies gently rising and falling in rhythm with one another's breathing. I woke to the cock's song. Outside, the air glistened misty gray, and in the dark recesses of the yard, toads and tree frogs still serenaded the night. Inside, my sisters and brothers curled against each other like newborn kittens. From Mommy and Papi's room came a rustle of sheets and hushed mumbles. I tiptoed to their door and a board creaked. "Who's there?" Mommy called out. "It's me," I whispered, walking in. Mommy lay in Papi's arms, her head on his shoulder, his left hand cradling her face. He quickly pulled their covers up, but I saw she was naked. She blushed, and even though Papi's skin was too dark to show it, I knew he blushed too by the startled expression on his face. "What are you doing up so early?" Mommy asked, sitting up. Her hair was matted against her neck, and she brushed it away with one hand, while with the other she held the covers up to her chest. "I don't know. I just woke up." "Go back to bed. It's too early." She lay down against Papi's shoulder again, and I backed out of the room, feeling left out. I stood on the other side of the door a while, but there was no sound from their room until I'd crossed the creaky floor. The rustles resumed and the throaty whispers. I lay on the living room couch and was lulled to sleep by the sound of my parents making love. Papi and Mommy started a business. We called it a cafetín ambulante, a small truck with compartments and shelves in the back, a refrigerated section, and a hot plate. From the truck, he sold coffee and pastries, the hot lunches Mommy cooked daily, and the bark cider he made by the gallon. The shelves were laden with snacks and sweets, which we were not allowed to touch. He drove to construction sites and broadcast the menu of the day through a loudspeaker. His rich baritone could be heard a mile away reciting poems about the food on the back of his truck. "They say my arroz con pollo is good, especially when enhanced by red beans, soaked overnight, cooked at low heat with ham and delectable spices. The plantains are ripe, fried until just right. The coffee steams hot like Vesuvius, the milk pasteurized, sugar del país. So you know it's sweet. Come see for yourself. Give your mouth a treat." The business didn't last very long. The truck was expensive to maintain. Bandits tried to mug him a few times, and he didn't have the heart to say no to men who bought on credit that never paid him back. The truck was returned to wherever it had come from, and Papi went back to his work, fixing other people's houses. Love made people do crazy things. Husbands shot wives in fits of passion, then turned the gun on themselves and splattered their brains all over the walls. The newspapers printed photographs of dismembered bodies, bloody sheets, rooms in which all the furniture had been upended and strewn as if by a hurricane. "Scene of the crime," the headlines read. On the radio, love was different. Men with rich voices who were always tall and dark won the hearts of young women who were always petite and innocent. Even if poor, the men were decent, worthy of respect, accomplished in the manly arts of riding and pistol shooting, but not reckless with either animals or firearms. The women suffered. Frequently, they were orphaned, brought up by nuns or stepmothers who made them do all the housework. In spite of this, they were cheerful and optimistic, never doubting that if they were pure of heart, life would eventually get better. I rushed home from school every day to sit by the radio for hours listening to the romantic tales of women with names like Mariana and Sofia, and men such as Armando and Ricardo. The more convoluted the storylines, the more I liked them. And I imagined that all the long-suffering heroines looked like me, or rather, that I looked like them. At night, I played out the fantasies, seeing myself race across a flower-strewn field, hair blowing wild, arms outstretched toward the waiting arms of a tall, dark Armando or Ricardo, who kissed me passionately in a frenzy of violins. I always fell asleep just as Armando or Ricardo touched my lips, and mornings I woke to the same embrace and a warm feeling between my legs that I savored until it faded like morning mist. According to the soap operas, someday I would fall in love at first sight, but my love and I would suffer before we could be happy. There would be illnesses from which I would recover just at the point of death. There would be evil women who would die, cheat, and try to maim me just to get their claws into my sweetheart. There would be wars and earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, epidemics, which I would survive by nursing those less fortunate, only to discover my beloved among the dying and revive him with the power of my brown eyes. All this I dreamed during those restless nights in my own room. At the same time, Mommy and Papi battled each other, intruding into my fantasies with their real-life love-hate relationship. Even though they'd lived together for 14 years, they weren't married, but it hadn't been an issue in our lives until Mommy returned from New York. All of a sudden, it seemed important to her that she and Papi be legal. They fought about it constantly. One minute, they were just like any other couple, doing things together, playing with us kids, boasting about our virtues to the neighbors. The next, they called each other names, spewed out ugly lists of offenses on both sides, with the recurrent theme of Mommy's uncertain status as a common law wife. I disappeared into my room the minute the air tensed and wrapped myself in a thin sheet that didn't silence their insults but made me invisible to the hate that clouded their eyes. I called up the images of Armando or Ricardo, and with Papi and Mami's shrill fights as background, I imagined a man and woman touching one another gently, discovering beauty in a stubbled cheek or a curl of hair, whispering adoring words into each other's ear, warming one another's bodies with love. Johannes Vélez noticed me, even though Maritza Ortiz said I was so ugly that no boy would ever want me. She was the most popular girl in seventh grade. I was nobody. Her reasons for picking on me were as mysterious as Johannes's reasons for catching up with me one day after school and offering to carry my books. "I can carry them myself," I snapped. "Oh, come on, Esmeralda," he mumbled, standing closer. "Don't make me look bad." A group of boys leaned against the wall of the school, pretending not to watch us. Maritza and her retinue giggled near them. I had not fallen in love at first sight with Johannes Vélez, but his eyes on me felt good, and I wanted very much to give him my books to carry. But I felt as if by handing them over, I would be relinquishing something more precious than my math homework, only I didn't know what that something might be. "You can do it tomorrow," I said, and walked off in a haze of fear and anger at my own stupidity. That night, Armando and Ricardo blended into the mournful face of Johannes Vélez. I replayed our encounter, only this time I was charming, confident, able to carry on a conversation that dazzled him, while Maritza and her friends watched enviously. "Mommy, what should I do if a boy wants to carry my books?" I asked the next morning. "Let him," she said, as she flipped an egg. She went to the door, pan in hand. "Delsa, Norma, Hector, you'd better get dressed fast, or you'll be late for school." She slid the egg on my plate. "Who wants to carry your books?" "Johannes Velez." "What kind of a name is that?" "I don't know." "Is he American?" "He's from around here." "Who's from around here?" Delsa asked, hopping to her chair. "Nagy's boyfriend," Alicia said from across the table. "He's no such thing," I yelled. Norma and Hector pushed each other to sit near the window. "Stop that," Mommy hollered. She broke three eggs into the pan. "Velez. I don't know a Velez family." As if everyone in the world had to check with her before moving to town. "There's a Velez in my class, Sarita Velez. She's a pest," Norma turned up her nose. "Not the same family," I bit back, possessive all of a sudden. "Nagy has a boyfriend," Hector sang. "I do not. Do so," Delsa and Norma joined in the chant, and Edna and Raymond appeared out of nowhere to torture me. "Mommy, make them stop. You kids, leave your sister alone." But they just lowered their voices to a whisper when Mommy turned her back. "Nagy has a boyfriend. Mommy!" I was embarrassed by their teasing and would have bopped them on the head if Mammy hadn't been right there. "You kids, get ready for school. Scram!" They left the table one at a time, Mammy taking threatening steps toward them each time they stopped to look back with mischievous expressions and a mouth, "Nagy has a boyfriend." I was humiliated. Tears formed in my eyes, making Mammy's face look out of focus. "If there's a boy who likes you," she rubbed my hair, "and you like him, ask him to visit you at home. That's the proper thing to do." "It's not like I'm getting married or anything. He just asked to carry my books." "I know, but you're casi señorita, and boys are interested. The thing is, no boy will respect you if you don't bring him home to meet your parents." I should never have asked her. She had no clue about my feelings. All she cared about was the boy, not me. "Why do you keep saying I'm casi señorita? When am I going to be a señorita without the almost?" "Nagy, don't take that tone of voice with me." "But when, Mommy? You keep saying I should do this, I shouldn't do that, I should do the other, all because I'm almost a señorita. What does that mean? What does it have to do with anything?" I heaved out sobs so full they scared me. She held me for a few minutes, then sent me to my room. "Take off your uniform before it gets wrinkled." "But I have to go to school," I wailed as if she'd just given me awful news. "You can be a little late. Lie down for a while, and I'll send a note that you weren't feeling well." I unsnapped my skirt and unbuttoned my shirt, tears streaming down my cheeks, sobs racking my chest so that I had to lean against the wall as I undressed. The world was a terrible, cruel place, a dark pit jawing open to swallow me in perpetual despair. Mommy sent Delsa, Norma, Hector, Alicia, and Edna to school, their protests proving my point, making me cry even harder. Raymond rubbed my leg gently, but I kicked him away, unwilling to accept pity. In the kitchen, Mommy scrubbed the dishes, sighing, "Ay, Dios mío santo, help me make it through their puberties." Our house sat on concrete stilts that allowed enough headroom underneath for us to stake out play areas with clearly defined boundaries. Discarded pieces of zinc, chicken wire, cardboard, torn sheets that Mammy had given us, and dried palm fronds formed the walls of our very own barrio under the house. My spot was on the back corner nearest the kitchen, where the land sloped toward Papi's shed. I couldn't quite stand up, but I could crawl in and kneel or squat comfortably. I had swept the ground smooth and placed mismatched tiles in the center for a colorful mosaic floor. It was there that I went when I was sick and tired of everybody, which was most of my 12th year. Through a hole in the burlap bag that served as the door of my hideaway, I had a view of the creek, the malanga and bananas growing on the slope, and the gardenia near the porch. The more I looked at it, the more I loved that bush that had never flowered. It was oval-shaped, with branches sticking out here and there like a woman who had not combed her hair. "Papi," I asked one night as he sat on the porch reading the paper, "how come the gardenia never blossoms?" "It probably needs water," he said. So every day I filled an old coffee can 2 or 3 times and watered around the roots of the bush, moistening the earth until it became spongy. The bush grew rounder, taller, its leaves thick and green. "If you prune the tips," Mommy said, "it will grow faster and fuller." With a rusty pair of scissors, I trimmed the branches. "I'm sorry, little tree," I murmured so no one could hear, "but I want you to grow and give us flowers." Whatever I cut off, I put under the bush to feed the roots. "I've taken real good care of it," I said to Papi, "but it still won't bloom." "It takes patience. You've only been doing it for a week. Give it time." "It won't flower when you want it to," Mommy said. "Keep taking care of it, and you'll see. One day it will surprise you." I stopped asking the bush to give me gardenias, but continued watering it and clipping its branches. The leaves grew larger, greener, veined underneath in pale chartreuse, the blades thick and full of liquid that I kept expecting to smell like gardenias, but it didn't. "It's probably a macho tree," Papi said. "It needs a female to blossom." "There's no such thing, Pablo," Mommy chided. "Gardenias are not like people." "But some plants need a male and a female before they can give fruit. Plantains, for example." "Yes, plantains, but not gardenias," she laughed, and Papi didn't say any more. Johannes Velez didn't ask to carry my books after I brushed them off, but during math class he stared at me. I smiled, but he looked at his notebook and seemed to be concentrating on the problems Mrs. Nunez had given us to solve. Every day for a week, I stopped to buckle my shoe or to drink from the hall fountain so that Johannes Velez would have enough time to catch up. But he didn't, and I couldn't bring myself to be the first to speak. One Saturday, as I watered my gardenia bush, he showed up. "Hola." He stood stiffly on the other side of the gate, sleepy eyes begging me to ask him in. My first instinct was to run and change my tattered dress for something nicer. At the same time, I was furious that he had just appeared uninvited. Mommy materialized on the porch steps as if she'd been expecting him. From every corner of the world, my sisters and brothers emerged to stare at us as though at animals in a zoo. "Buenas tardes," Mommy said, wiping her hands against her hips. "Negi, is this your friend from school?" I wished a bolt of lightning would strike me dead right then and there. The idea that he now knew I talked about him to my mother. My mother! "See?" I growled. "Aren't you going to ask him in?" She was as cheerful as a sparrow, while I wanted nothing more than to be swallowed by the earth in one gulp. "Come in," I mumbled and raced up the porch steps. He sat on the sofa, silent and dignified, while Mommy fed him crackers and lemonade. My sisters and brothers casually arranged themselves around the room, pretending to read or play jacks while keeping an eye on everything that went on. I wanted to swat them away like flies. "I know some Velezes in Bayamón," Mommy said, "and there are some in Caguas." I bet there were Velezes in every single town of the island, but she acted as if she knew them all. "My family is from Ponce, but my dad is stationed at the Roosevelt base." "Oh," she was impressed. "His father was a military man with a steady job." "Where did you get such a funny name?" I asked, evil as the radio vixens. His chocolate skin reddened. Mommy glared at me. My sisters and brothers stifled giggles. I guess my dad chose it. I was born in Kentucky." "Kentucky?" Mommy murmured. "An American as my first suitor." "There's a Johannesburg in South Africa. Is that what you're named after? A city?" The kids laughed and Johannes bit his lip. "Negi," Mommy commanded, "come into the kitchen a minute." As soon as we were on the other side of the wall, she grabbed my arm. "You're being very rude to your friend." "He's not my friend. I didn't ask him to come. He just showed up." "Well, he's here, and you must treat him with respect. Now get in there and behave like a proper señorita." "All the kids are watching. They'll make fun of me." "See if he wants to go outside. Show him your gardenia bush or something. I'll keep the kids here. Wait a minute." She moistened a rag and wiped my face and neck. "Scrub those grimy hands before you go." We went back to the living room, where Johannes sat examining Hector's new red and yellow top. "Wanna see a tree?" I asked. Mommy rolled her eyes. We stepped into the yard, trailed by Delsa, Norma, Hector, Alicia, Edna, and Raymond. "You kids stay with me," Mommy called. "I have to get my marbles," Raymond wailed. "Get them later. Come in here now." I led Johannes to the creek, away from the house, but within view of Mommy, who would be watching. "Your mother is very nice," he said. "What are you doing here?" I couldn't help myself. He was the cutest boy in seventh grade, and I liked him. But every time I opened my mouth, something nasty came out, as if the part of me that spoke was different from the part of me that felt. I tried to remember what soap opera heroines said to their lovers, but I couldn't compare this boy in shorts and knee socks to the manly Ricardos and Armandos, and I was no heroine, not in my faded dress and worn shoes. We stood by the creek, Johannes telling me about his dad's work as a sergeant in the army, the many places he'd lived, how they were moving again to Colorado. But I didn't want to hear any of that. I wanted to hear a man's soft voice telling me I was beautiful, that he would love me forever, that life would mean nothing without me. I tuned into the creek's gurgle, imagining a pristine river on a deserted island, its shore lined with orchids and gardenias, with birds warbling sweet melodies. I wanted to dance to this music in my head, but when I took a step, I tumbled into the creek with a wild splash. Johannes stood on the bank, stupefied. I fought the sucking mud and crawled out like some prehistoric creature from an ancient lagoon, just as Mommy and my sisters and brothers came running. "You'd better go home now," I told Johannes through my tears. The last I saw of him was his straight back convulsed in laughter, his khaki pants and knee socks spattered with mud. Mommy took Edna and Raymond to buy shoes, and I sat on the porch reading a Corinne Tellado romance instead of watching my sisters and brother, who disappeared whenever I was in charge. A man came out of the house where Una Gente Rica lived, his eyes shaded by a straw sombrero. He wore a yellow shirt tucked into white pants, and something about the way he moved reminded me of Jorge Negrete, the Mexican movie star. His broad shoulders tapered to a narrow waist, and he walked with the swagger of someone who wore a six-shooter on each hip. He sat on a rock, dangled his hands between his knees, and stared at the quickly flowing water as if it held a secret. My heart thumped the name Armando, whispered hoarsely as in the radio soap operas, and I willed him to look up and fall in love with me at first sight. But he just stared numbly at the stream, his face invisible under his hat. I ran inside, combed my hair, washed my face, and tugged here and there so that the bodice of my dress lay flat against the bumps on my chest. With trembling fingers, I undid one of the buttons to show an inch more skin where the cleavage should have been. When I returned, he was on his back, hands under his neck, sombrero over his face. The afternoon was quiet, disturbed only by the rushing stream and the buzzing of a colibri around my gardenia bush. A flower now bloomed on the side of the bush facing the water, the first to bloom of hundreds of buds that studded the tree like pale gems. I nipped it, brought it to my face, and buried myself in its fragrance. He rose and looked across to where I stood. I felt dangerous, bold, older by years, inspired by all the Marianas and Sofias, whose emotional ups and downs had fed my romantic fantasies. I looked at him, and my gaze was met by an amazingly blue pair of eyes against cinnamon skin and a faint smile tickling white teeth. He tipped his hat in greeting. I nodded, then stuck the hem of the gardenia in the open buttonhole, where it flopped in the wide space between my soon-to-be breasts. He chuckled, but I didn't mind. I took the gardenia out, pinned it behind my right ear, where I thought it accentuated my intensely black eyes. I felt beautiful, fragrant, warm as the morning sun. I leaned against the mango tree, throwing my chest up the way I'd seen Maria Felix do in movies when Jorge Negrete was about to kiss her. The man across the way folded his arms across his chest and smiled broadly. I closed my eyes. Negi, what are you doing? Mammy stood outside the gate staring, with Edna and Raymond snickering behind her. She scraped open the gate against the cement walk, and I quickly buttoned my blouse. She stared at the man walking up the bank toward the big house on the corner. Who was that?
Who?
That man across the creek. He'd gone into the house as quickly as he'd appeared. I don't see anyone. Get inside and help me with these bundles, she said, dropping a shopping bag into my arms. And I don't want you out here again when that man is out. On the rocking chair, my Corintellado book flapped in the breeze. I wish you'd stop reading this trash, she said, and flung it inside where it fell under the sofa to be retrieved later. Mommy and Papi's arguments became unbearable. They screamed at each other, ruptured the night with insults and hate-filled words that echoed in my head for days. I lay in bed crying, afraid to step into the room where I heard things breaking, but the next morning there were no mismatched pieces, no chips or fragments, nothing to sweep away. We had breakfast in silence long after Papi left for work, Mommy distant as another country, shrouded by something dark and grievous that we couldn't break through. She served us, helped us dress, sent us off to school, and left for her own job in a fog of pain that obliterated all hope, all romance. I tried to disappear within the hallways of Ramon Emeterio Betances' school, where children from happy homes crowded in cheery groups. The school library became a refuge from would-be friends, and I sat for hours reading fairy tales, diving into them as into a warm pool that washed away the fear, the sadness, the horror of living in a home where there was no love. Don't be so dramatic, Mammy scolded as she wrestled with a chicken whose neck she was about to wring. But it's true, I sobbed. Nobody loves me. I have no friends. Kids tease me all the time. And you and Papi? My throat closed. The chicken flapped its wings wildly. Downy feathers floated around Mommy like a nimbus. Woof, this one doesn't want to be eaten. She tugged hard, and the chicken's neck cracked. She grinned. There. The bird's wings slowed as if it were flying through water. You're not even listening, I whined. She sighed deeply, hung the chicken on the side of the house, and wiped her hands on her dress. Negi, we love you, but what goes on between me and your papi is our business. We have our problems just like every other couple. I don't hear all the neighbors yelling and screaming at each other like you do. Now you're being disrespectful. The warning in her voice made me back down. It's not fair, I mumbled. What's not fair? Nothing's fair. Life's not fair, I wailed in a fresh fit of tears. She sat next to me on the steps and draped her arms around me. Her body jiggled, and when I looked up, tears streamed down her cheeks, but her mouth was curled into a smile that she was trying hard to conceal. What's so funny? I cried, on the verge of catching her giggles. Nothing, Mommy said, laughing and kissing the top of my head. Nothing's funny. We sat on the steps holding each other, laughing and crying at nothing, the chicken's wings thumping against the side of the house. Next week you will be a teenager, Papi said as we sat on the porch smelling the night air. What's that? In the United States, when children reach the age of 13, they're called teenagers. It comes from the ending of the number in English, 13, teenager. I counted in English to myself. So I will be a teenager until I'm 20? That's right. Soon you'll be wanting to rock and roll. He laughed as if he had told a very funny joke. I don't like rock and roll, I protested. Too noisy. And it's all in English. I don't understand the songs. Mark my words, he said. When you're a teenager, it's like something comes over you. Rock and roll sounds good. Believe me. He laughed as if I knew what he was talking about. I hadn't seen him this happy in a long time. Well, it's not going to happen to me, I pouted and ignored his chuckles at my expense. Just wait, he said. Once you're in New York, you'll become a regular teenager Americana. I'm not going to New York. Your mother's talking about moving there. My stomach fell to my feet. What? Didn't you tell them, Monin? He called into the house, where Mammy and the kids watched the program on our very own black and white television set. Tell them what? She came out to the porch, hands on hips. That you're moving to New York? He didn't look at her. He just spit out the words like phlegm into the night. Pablo, she said as one might murmur a prayer. Is it true, Mommy? Laughter came from the living room where my sisters and brothers watched Don Cholito slapstick. How can you be so cruel, she said to Papi. You know I have no choice. You have a choice, he growled. Stay here, put up with your poca vergüenzas. I've given you a home. I'm not a rich man, but we've always had enough to eat. Do you consider that enough? Her voice was tense and rising in pitch. I don't know what you want from me, Moning. I just don't know. I've lived with you for 14 years. We have 7 children together. You won't marry me. You won't leave me alone. Is that what you want? Marriage? What would that do? I've recognized them all. They all have my last name. Mommy, Papi, please. Rage transformed them. A red fury choked the good in both of them and bottled the love they once felt into a dark place where neither could find it. Please stop. Their hands formed into fists. Their eyes squinted into slits that sent out invisible daggers. Please, Mommy and Papi. They growled words that made no sense, echoes of all the hurts and insults, the dinners gone to waste, the women, the abandonments. I crouched against the wall and watched them injure each other without touching each other, hurling words that had the same effect as acid on metal. Each word diminished them, flattened them against the night until they were puppets, pointing fingers in each other's faces. Their voices extinguished night sounds, and darkness swallowed everything but these two people I loved, the overhead light a dim spotlight that disfigured their features into grimaces. One by one, Delsa, Norma, Hector, Alicia, Edna, and Raymond came out on the porch, their eyes round as guavas, tears glistening the tips of their lashes. In their passion, Mommy and Papi had forgotten about us. They were real only to one another. We huddled in a corner, afraid that if we left them, they might eat each other. August marked the beginning of hurricane season. Thunder and lightning broke overhead, while in our house a dreadful calm settled like clear water in a tainted pool. Mommy prepared for our trip with the steady resolve of someone who never looks back. She bought suitcases and filled them with our good clothes, allowing us to wear only the faded dresses and shirts that we would leave behind like butterflies a cocoon. Edna, Raymond, and I were to go with her. Delsa, Norma, Hector, and Alicia would stay with Papi until Mommy could save enough money for their airfare. "Does this mean you're divorcing Papi?" I asked. "We were never married," she answered. "We can't get divorced." "Why doesn't he marry you?" "He says he doesn't love me anymore." "Do you love him?" "It doesn't matter." She was a stone packed inside a shell that wouldn't crack. Papi was numb, detached even from himself, his voice flat, his step so light it was difficult to know he was there at all. We tiptoed around them and saved our voices for play far from the house, where even our laughter was received by Mommy and Papi with a stare, a quizzical look, a warning glance. "Your father is a good man," Mommy told me. "Don't you ever think otherwise." It didn't seem possible that he was a good man when he wasn't fighting for her or for us. He was letting us go to New York, as if it no longer mattered where we were, as if the many leavings and reconciliations that exhausted him had burnt out whatever spark had made him search for us in swamps and fetid lagoons. "No, I'll never go there," he said when I asked, and a wound opened in my heart that I was certain would never heal. He brought me magazines with pictures of Fabian and Bobby Rydell and encouraged me to accept what was coming with no questions, no backward glances, as if these teenage idols could ever take the place he was so willingly giving up. I tacked the pin-up photos on my wall next to Don Luis Llorens Torres, whose poems had inspired me to love my country, its jíbaros, and the wild natural beauty that could be found even in the foul air of El Mangle. When the day finally came, he drove us to the airport, the radio tuned to the American radio station where Brenda Lee sang her regrets. He hummed along with her, his eyes focused on the road, the rest of us silent as fog. At the airport, he unloaded our bags, helped us verify our tickets. I kept expecting him to change his mind, to get down on his knees and beg Mommy not to leave. But he didn't. When it was time to go, he kissed us goodbye, held us for a long time. I grasped his neck and pressed myself against his chest, smelled the minty fragrance of his aftershave, tickled my fingers through his kinky hair. Behind him, Mommy gathered Edna and Raymond, her eyes focused on the door to the tarmac, her mouth set in a solid line. I didn't want to give up either one of them, but it felt as if I were losing them both. Papi pushed me away, kissed both of my cheeks, and brushed the hair from my eyes. "Write to me," he said. "Don't forget." Edna, Raymond, and I followed Mommy outside the terminal, down the strip to the waiting plane, gray and cold in the dusk. I looked behind me at Papi, his face inscrutable, at Delsa, Norma, Hector, and Alicia huddled against the terminal window. Several times I bumped into Mommy as I walked backwards, unwilling to face the metal bird that would whisk us to our new life. She tugged on my arm and swung me around to face forward, but I kept turning back to the horizon dotted with palm trees in front of moss-green mountains that rose to an innocent pink sky. Mammy pushed me into the plane, down a long aisle lined with seats dead-ending against a wall, my first glimpse of what New York would be like. Across the aisle, Mammy's eyes were misty. She stretched her fingers toward mine, and we held hands as the plane rose above the clouds. Neither one of us could have known what lay ahead. For her, it began as an adventure and turned out to have more twists and turns than she expected or knew how to handle. For me, the person I was becoming when we left was erased and another one was created. The Puerto Rican jíbara, who longed for the green quiet of a tropical afternoon, was to become a hybrid who would never forgive the uprooting. Angels on the Ceiling. Ahí fue donde la puerca entorchó el rabo. That's where the sow's tail curled. Uniformed women with lacquered hair, high heels, and fitted skirts looked down on us, signaled that we should fasten our safety belts, place parcels under the seat in front of us, and sit up. "Stewardesses," Mommy said, admiring their sleek uniforms, pressed white blouses, stiff navy ribbons tied into perfect bows in their hair. None of them spoke Spanish. Their tight smiles were not convincing, did not welcome us. In our best clothes, with hair combed, faces scrubbed, the dirt under our nails gouged out by Mommy's stiff brush, I still felt unclean next to the highly groomed, perfumed, unwrinkled women who waited on us. Someday, Mommy mused, you might like to be a stewardess. Then you can travel all over the world for free. The stewardesses minced up and down the narrow aisle, glancing from side to side like queens greeting the masses. I tried to read in their faces where else they'd been, if their travels had taken them to places like Mongolia, Singapore, Timbuktu. That's where I'd want to go if I were a stewardess. Not New York, Paris, or Rome. I'd want to go places so far away that I couldn't even pronounce their names. I'd want to see sights so different that it would show on my face.